Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Barack Obama flip-flops on public financing. The media were in an uproar over the Democratic presidential candidate's decision to forego public funding for the general election, a sign to many pundits that Obama's reformer rhetoric is an illusion. But was it actually a flip-flop? Writer John K. Wilson doesn't think so. He'll join us to explain. Also on Counterspin today, some in the press corps say that the new surveillance law making its way through Congress is a good deal, not just for the telecom companies that it lets off the hook for helping the government with its illegal spying programs, but even for those who worry about civil liberties and privacy. Our guest begs to differ. We'll hear from Aziz Huq from the Brennan Center for Justice. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
When critics of the Iraq War suggested years ago that the invasion might be about oil, the pundits scoffed. Well, it must have been confusing for them then when the front page of the New York Times on June 19th announced that the Iraqi oil ministry, in consultation with U.S. advisors, would be awarding no-bid contracts to U.S. oil companies, inviting them back into the country for the first time in over three decades. This news likely came as no surprise in Iraq, where more than three-quarters of the population now believe that the U.S. invasion was a bid for control of their natural resources. But the Washington Post worried on June 20th that the no-bid contracts are, quote, likely to revive speculation that the Iraq war was motivated by a desire to tap into reserves that were controlled by foreigners until the 1960s, when the industry was nationalized. The belief is widespread in the Arab world, close quote. Actually, this belief is widespread around the world. Polls consistently find that European majorities believe that oil was a prime motivator for the invasion. And last fall, the New York Times reported that a quarter of Americans were thinking along the same lines. USA Today somehow managed to see this all as good news. A June 20th article headlined, "In Iraq's oil fields, signs of hope finally are emerging," painted a rosy picture of the situation. The article was filled with cheery news about economic development and support for the new oil deals among Iraqis. Well, at least among the two Iraqis the paper found to quote. As for the reported 63% of Iraqis who want foreign oil companies kept out of the country, well, USA Today seemed to have trouble finding any of them.
The New York Times reported on June 20th that a recent Israeli military drill seemed to be a rehearsal for an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. The Times article was, unsurprisingly, largely based on anonymous sources at the Pentagon, who could not be named, quote, because of the political delicacy of the matter, close quote. We've heard that one before. The paper did acknowledge that an Israeli attack, quote, would confront a number of challenges, close quote. But the paper's list of potential problems was rather short. The airstrikes probably wouldn't eliminate the Iranian program, so Israel would need to make multiple attacks, which could be beyond their military capabilities. On the other hand, the Times noted that, quote, waiting also entails risks. Israeli officials have repeatedly expressed fears that Iran will soon master the technology it needs to produce substantial quantities of highly enriched uranium for nuclear weapons, close quote. Unmentioned by the Times is another idea that might give some pause. Launching an unprovoked attack on another country is illegal, according to most interpretations of international law. But the issue of legality is rarely raised in the media. On CBS Evening News, correspondent David Martin closed his June 20th report by saying, quote, for many countries, choosing between bombing Iran and Iran with a bomb is a tough call, but there's no doubt what choice Israel would make, close quote. It's firstly, of course, bizarre to say those are the only two options, and even if they were, it's safe to assume that many countries would argue that such an attack would be a violation of law, not to mention a near-certain invitation for more war across the Middle East. If, as seems clear, anonymous government officials and some right-wing pundits are going to continue to agitate for bombing Iran, a little media scrutiny, not to mention sanity, is certainly warranted.
According to the campaign conventional wisdom, John McCain's big problem could be George W. Bush. Voters apparently don't want to see much that might remind them of the outgoing president. So McCain, who shares most of Bush's policy ideas, must work to appear less like Bush than he really is. The media provide McCain a valuable service by muddying all of this up. On June 20th, the Los Angeles Times turned in a piece headlined, "McCain Struggles to Break Free of Bush." The struggles that are cited, though, are kind of strange. The lead example is the fact that McCain went to Iowa to see flood damage the same day as Bush. The second example was actually substantive. McCain came out in favor of offshore oil drilling, but then Bush did too. The fact that McCain has reversed himself to back a Bush policy isn't a new struggle, though. He's done it countless times. The rest of the article recounts McCain's repeated attempts to distance himself from the Bush legacy. But the two are far more alike than different when it comes to actual policy matters, which is something the media should explain clearly, not obscure. The New York Times took a similar approach with potentially unhelpful comparisons between McCain and former Senator Bob Dole. "Two Republican contenders whose similarities are mostly skin deep," read the June 22nd headline. The piece argued that McCain is no Bob Dole, but the most important differences raised by the Times have nothing to do with actual policy. McCain, we're told, is funny, whereas Dole reined in his humor. Voters are not exactly well served by such observations.
The Washington Post's Richard Cohen devotes the first half of his June 24th column to criticizing Barack Obama for changing his decision on accepting public financing. In the second half, Cohen offers a response to the accusation that he and some of his media colleagues are soft on John McCain, particularly in failing to hold him to account for flip-flops or reversals of positions in the same way other candidates are. Cohen's counter-argument is both baffling and worrisome. He runs down some of McCain's high-profile reversals or changed positions on immigration, tax cuts for the wealthy, campaign spending as it applies to use of his wife's corporate airplane, and most recently offshore drilling, as well as noting his denunciation and then embrace of certain ministers and his mind change about the Confederate flag. But none of this matters, Cohen argues, because McCain is, in Cohen's words, a known commodity. Quote, "we know his bottom line," close quote. Well, leaving aside who we are, how can McCain be a known commodity when he's changed so much? And why should the very same actions lead to charges of flip-flopping for Obama but not for McCain? Cohen's answer is that Obama, quote, "lacks the job references McCain picked up in a North Vietnamese prison," close quote. For Cohen, all voters need to know about McCain is that, quote, "as his North Vietnamese captors found out, there is only so far he will go, and then his pride or his sense of honor takes over," close quote. Obama may have core principles, but we don't know what they are because nothing in his life can compare with McCain's POW experience. Richard Cohen's suggestion that people should vote for a candidate based not on his positions on issues, but on the undefined but certain sense that there is only so far he will go is strange enough. Stranger still that he thinks this reads as an answer to the criticism that some pundits go all gooey when it comes to John McCain.
And finally, comedian George Carlin died June 22nd at age 71. Carlin, whose commentary often focused on media powers that be, along with politicians, marketers, and many other things, was a friend and supporter of Fair, and he will surely be missed. Free speech advocates may remember him best for his routine Filthy Words, which Counterspin home station WBAI aired in 1973. The station's airing of Carlin's words led to the 1978 Supreme Court case, FCC versus Pacifica Foundation, in which the broadcast was declared indecent but not obscene, a ruling that gave the FCC the controversial obscenity monitoring powers it retains today. Current WBAI general manager Anthony Riddle told the New York Times that what's sometimes called the Carlin case was about more than just radio. It was about the right to be human beings in the United States. Riddle also noted that broadcasting Carlin's famous seven dirty words today could cost a radio station $360,000 per incident. That's one of many lessons Carlin taught. Free speech isn't cheap.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Barack Obama's decision to forgo public financing for the general election campaign didn't come as a surprise. The candidate's ability to raise money on his own has been obvious for months, so adhering to the $85 million public system would actually nullify one of Obama's most important strengths. That's the practical argument. But to many pundits, the decision was a flagrant violation of Obama's past statements, if not the whole essence of his campaign. Was it really a flip-flop? Though. Our next guest says the media's got this one all wrong. John K. Wilson is a writer and author of several books, the latest being Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest. John K. Wilson, welcome to Counterspin.
Glad to be with you.
The media reaction to this decision has been almost universally critical. Gag me with a stick, said Sam Donaldson. He's rigging the system in his favor, according to David Broder. NPR's Scott Simon said it raises fair questions about the sincerity of his campaign promises. Scott Simon even asked whether it was decent to spend so much while other Americans struggle. PBS liberal Mark Shields called it a flip-flop of epic proportions. We could go on like this all day. But what did, when you get down to it, what did Obama actually promise or pledge to do here?
Well, Obama's been very consistent on this. And from the very beginning, when he first brought up this pledge in February of 2007, when he began his campaign, he said that this is a conditional pledge, not just conditional on the Republicans agreeing to it, but conditional on having what he called a fundraising truce, making sure that the candidates were not cheating the system, were doing something about the fundraising by the political parties, as well as trying to stop the 527s from swift voting either candidate. And so Barack Obama never made a pledge that he would take public financing under any conditions. He always said that it was going to be based on an agreement between him and the Republican candidate.
Now, the counter argument that a few pundits have been stressing, not very many, but a few, they've been saying that Obama did say on several occasions, including one of the candidates' debates, that he would sit down with his Republican opponent to talk about a system that would work for everyone. Amidst all this outrage, that's the point that some pundits like George Stephanopoulos are making. Do you think that's a fair critique of Obama? Does that open him up to the actual charge of being a flip-flopper?
Well, he did promise that he would aggressively pursue an agreement. Mm-hmm. And at times he has said that he would sit down with McCain. It's not altogether clear if he meant that he would do that personally or, as happened, that their top lawyers would meet and discuss this issue. So I think there is a legitimate question as to whether he was really aggressive in pursuing an agreement. But that's not what the media reported. The media didn't report that he broke a pledge to aggressively pursue an agreement. They reported that he broke a pledge to take public financing. And that's what was so inaccurate about the media coverage.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of context that goes missing in some of this coverage. The disadvantage among the parties, the Republican National Party, the Democratic National Party, in terms of fundraising, the 527s on the Republican side versus the Democratic side. What do you think you make of that kind of context? It's missing from the media, but what should people know about the rest of that story?
Well, the media reported that Barack Obama said the public financing system was broken, but they didn't talk at all about how it's broken. And one of the ways, for example, in this is that if Obama had taken the public financing, he would have been at a huge disadvantage to McCain, who has close to a $50 million fundraising edge within the Democratic National Committee versus the Republican National Committee. What would have had to happen, and what always happens, is that public financing does not end the corruption and the money and the fundraising process in presidential campaigns. Instead, what happens is the candidates raise money for their Democratic or Republican national committees, who can take donations up to $28,500. So in many ways, the existing system is broken, and it leads to more of the corruption and more of the influence of big money in politics than the system of taking $2,300 donations from individuals for a candidate.
And that party money is real money. It's going to go into the campaign, right?
Right. That's real money, and it really is directed by the parties and focused on the presidential campaigns. And so that's different from the 527s, who are limited in certain ways. It's different from the money going into congressional committee fundraising. This is aimed really at the presidential race. And there was really no reporting by the media of the fact that Obama would have had to have done this and would have been at this disadvantage if he had taken this public funding.
The other line you hear from the media often is that Obama says he's afraid of 527s attacking him, or swift boating him, as the term is used now. And the line from the media is that there aren't any anti-Obama 527s out there. So what is he talking about?
Well, that's not true. There are 527s out there. There are going to be 527s that can be started in an instant and funded with unlimited donations from right-wingers out to attack him. And really, one of the big differences between the two campaigns that, again, wasn't brought up is that McCain has thrown up his arms and said, I'm no referee, and Obama has really taken a stand to convince his allies not to start 527s, and MoveOn.org, because of that, shut down their 527. So the two candidates have been very different in their approach to this.
There's another distinction, a double standard, if you will. The Obama campaign has tried to point this out. It's not getting as much pickup, is about McCain's record on public financing. He was in public financing for the primaries, and then he unilaterally pulled out of it. It's a legally questionable maneuver. Is McCain's situation just too murky for reporters to understand, or does he have credibility in the bank on campaign finance reform so that you just don't ask these questions about him?
Well, I think there is this presumption, this myth out there that McCain must be honest because we've called him a maverick for all these years and because he authored this legislation. They don't want to point out, even though it would be a really good story, about how he broke his own law. And what he did was he used the promise of public financing to secure a loan and to get easy access on the ballot. And the FEC doesn't allow you at that point to back off. And so McCain has already violated the law by spending beyond what is allowed in the primaries. And this is simply being overlooked, I think, because it's complex. And the same came true with this myth of Obama's broken pledge on public financing. Reporting what the pledge actually was to aggressively pursue an agreement and talking about all these details simply didn't fit in with what the media wanted to do, which was to describe a very simple-minded narrative of some candidate, a politician, breaking a promise. The fact that he hadn't broken that promise didn't really matter as much as the narrative.
And finally, whatever you make of Obama's decision, you have to marvel at the volume and the tone of the coverage of this. What do you make of this? Why did this issue get so many journalists so angry?
First of all, I think a lot of journalists are intellectually lazy, and they don't want to look at these kind of issues, and they're looking for a very simple narrative such as politician gone bad. They love the story of the goo-goos gone bad, of good government types who somehow violate this and aren't as pristine as they may present themselves to be. And so I think a lot of that has to do with this. Another reason is that the media are under extreme pressure from the right wing, which claims they've been pro-Obama. And so they're, I think, looking for stories where they can show that they're not supportive of Obama and they're willing to go out and attack him.
We've been speaking with author John K. Wilson. His most recent book is Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest. John K. Wilson, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
In a June 20th editorial, The Washington Post endorsed the new surveillance legislation that recently passed the House, saying the FISA Amendments Act, quote, brings the country's surveillance laws into the 21st century while protecting civil liberties and preserving important national security prerogatives, close quote. The paper called it welcome evidence that congressional leaders can still achieve delicate compromise in the national interest. Well, readers are clearly intended to see things as new and improved, but the paper doesn't indicate what exactly about these spying laws needed modernizing. There's just a nod to the granting of immunity to the telecommunications companies that helped the White House with its illegal spying programs. The Post calls that providing appropriate protections. What's getting lost in the Post and others' rendering of this legislation? Joining us now to talk about this is Aziz Huq, director of the Liberty and National Security Project at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome back to Counterspin, Aziz Huq.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, not everyone supports this law the way the Washington Post does. The New York Times, for one, editorialized against it. But one thing that has been fairly widespread in the discussion is the reference to this new surveillance legislation as a compromise. You think, as I understand it, that even that starting point is a misrepresentation of sorts.
I do think it's a misrepresentation. I think that there are two key questions on which Congress could have compromised. And really didn't, but accepted the administration's position. The first is whether to abandon the system of granting warrants that we have had until now, whereby warrants are granted on an individual basis. A court looks at an individual person's surveillance and says this is okay or not.
Mm-hmm.
What the new legislation would do is shift from that individualized system to basically a bucket system, where the government would get approval for and a court would review not individualized warrants, but entire programs which could sweep in thousands of people and last up to a year under the present draft of the legislation. That's a tremendous difference in terms of the kind of review and the kind of oversight that's being offered. The second point where there's really not been a compromise is immunity, where, as you said, the argument has been that this is what the new legislation gives is appropriate protection. Really, what it gives is carte blanche immunity to the telecoms companies that collaborated with the administration in what is generally accepted to be clearly illegal surveillance. But it cloaks that carte blanche with a patina of judicial involvement, enough that Congress or the administration can say, well, the courts have signed off on this, but in fact, there has been no substance to that review.
Well, let's look a little more at that immunity, because the Washington Post says in one write-up that the new law gives courts, quote, the chance to evaluate whether telecommunications companies deserve retroactive protection from lawsuits, close quote. And you say that's really just not true.
That's false. What the law requires the court to do is to ask whether the telecom company has a certification from the president that says, A, the president had authorized the surveillance, and B, either the attorney general or the head of an intelligence agency component or his deputy signed off on that surveillance. It is generally understood, and Republican leaders in both the House and Senate have said, that that provision has been drafted so as to map onto the certifications that were given to telecom companies while the illegal surveillance was going on. The critical thing to realize then is that those certifications were not enough under the law. You can't just have the president say, well, this is okay, and the telecom company give over the data that was required. So under this new law, the court would simply look to see whether the telecom company had the piece of paper and would not look see whether that piece of paper complied with the law as it stood in 2001, 2002, 2003. And the court would be unable to look behind the piece of paper to see whether what the telecom company actually did, what its underlying actions were illegal or legal.
They're doing it retroactively because that's the kind of certification that they actually
right,
had.
Right. You can imagine that the person who was writing the law literally had the whatever form that the president and the attorney general signed in 2002, 3, and 4 in front of them, and they're essentially copying out into the law what that form said. Certainly, under this new law, the court would never look at whether either the underlying surveillance was legal or illegal, or whether the decision of the telecom companies to provide assistance, a decision that was regulated at the time by federal law, and which, if assistance was provided inappropriately, is subject not just to civil sanctions, but is criminal in some instances, whether that was legal or illegal. The court simply can't look at those questions.
I take it you don't have much truck with the argument as presented by Time magazine that, you know, sure, the telecommunications companies are casting this as a victory, but as they put it, they will hardly have a free ride once litigation and lobbying fees have been added up.
Well, I think that the issue here is not one of, you know, how much does it cost to buy X number of legislators in the House and the Senate. I think that the issue is rather under circumstances in which a significant number of members of the American public have had their privacy rights violated for a period of 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and where the telecom companies have been complicit in those violations, where the pattern of violations may be continuing, I think that there is an interest that the public has in understanding what happened and knowing why it happened and in ensuring that it doesn't happen again. And the question of how much the telecoms companies may have paid to buy a congressman or two is simply beside the point.
Let me bring you back to something that the Washington Post, kind of a theme that they worked in their editorial endorsement, which is that this brings us into the 21st century. What do you make of that whole background that the reason for this Amendments Act is that we needed to upgrade or update our spying capabilities?
For one thing, that has nothing to do with the immunity provision. Mm-hmm. With regard to the new powers, the kind of bucket warrants that are required, the argument is look, you know, technology has changed at an accelerating pace. There's an enormous volume of communications, much more difficult to look at them individually. There's certainly something to that, but the Post is deliberately failing to mention or downplaying the flip side of it, which is that we are individually much more vulnerable to surveillance because we depend upon electronic communications, email, telephone calls, and the like, than 30 years ago. So much more of our private life is exposed through our banking records, our communications records, our traveling records than has ever been the case in the past. So the power of government to gather data on us, to use that data potentially against us, is astronomically greater than it was in the past. And so to say that technological change means that you need to give the government new powers is a bad argument. Technological change makes us much, much more vulnerable to invasions of privacy. And the really hard question, the question that the Post seemingly doesn't even ask, let alone answer, is how do those vulnerabilities get addressed?
We've been speaking with Aziz Huq. He's director of the Liberty and National Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice. You can find them online at brennancenter.org. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.